This week we open the fourth of the Chumashim, Chumash Bamidbar, and I would like to devote quite some time this evening, at the beginning of the Shiur, to the topic of Chumash Bamidbar. And as we will see, there's quite a bit to say, and there is parshanut of all stripes, so we need to be vigilant. According to Chazal, this is a Medrash Bereishis Rabbah, the five Chumashim correspond to the five references to the word or light in the Bria, in the Maisa Bereishis. The Pasuk says that we know the Psukim. I'm not sure if we independently would have counted the number of times it says the word or, but the Pasuk states, Vayomer Elohim Yihi Or, number one, Vayihi Or, number two, Vayar Elohim es ha'or kitov, number three. Vayavdel Elohim bein ha'or uvein ha'choshech, number four. And Vayikra Elohim la'or yo, number five. And of course, it's not hard to fathom the association, because we say that Torah is or, kiner mitzvah v'torah or, and the five oros, therefore, mentioned at the beginning of the Bria, the Medrash sees a correspondence to the five Chumashim. What's interesting is the four Chumashim, or four of the five, it's easy to see how they are a certain type of or. If we look at or as anything that's beneficial, productive, comes to light. Well, Bereishis, of course, is Vayihi Or. It's the light of existence. Chumash Shemos, Vayihi Or. We refer to it as the Chumash HaGeula, Me'afela La'ora. The Jewish people came out from the darkness of Golus to the light of Geula. Chumash Vayikra is all mitzvahs, and that represents Or in the sense of understanding, the Or HaSeichel. And Chumash Devarim, moving over Bamidbar for a moment, Chumash Devarim also has its Or, because Chumash Devarim is where Moshe begins to explain the Torah in a way that had not been explained until that point. Ho'il Moshe Be'er Es HaTorah Hazos, which brought things greater to light. This brings us back now to the fourth reference, Chumash Bamidbar, which corresponds to the words Vayavdel Elohim Bein Ha'or Ubein HaChoshech. There's some type of division between Or and Choshech, and that is a reference or an allusion to Chumash Bamidbar, and we need to understand how is it characteristic of Chumash Bamidbar to apply and adduce the phrase Vayavdel Elohim Bein Ha'or Uvein HaChoshech. We refer to this Chumash as Chumash Bamidbar. That's a reference of convenience, in the sense that we take the first word that seems to be more than Vaidaber, and that becomes the word of the Chumash, that becomes the name of the Chumash. Bereishis is Bereishis, Shemos is Shemos, Vayikra, Bamidbar, Devarim. Those are not necessarily characteristic names. And actually, Chazal have their own names for the Chumashim, which are characteristic. Vayikra, for example, will be called Toras Kohanim. Toras Kohanim, it tells you what it's about. It's about the Kohanim. Mishneh Torah is called Mishneh Torah, the review, so to speak, to oversimplify, of the Torah. And what about Bamidbar? Ironically, the English translation is closer to that. Vayikra is called Leviticus. We call it Toras Kohanim, they could have called it Kohanicus, I guess. I don't know if it has the same ring to it. And Mishneh Torah is Deuteronomy, Mishneh Torah. So someone got it right there. They're characteristic. What about Bamidbar? Chazal throughout the Shas refer to Bamidbar as Chumash HaPikudim, the Chumash of the counting. And once again, that corresponds, Lahavdil, to numbers. Indeed, there are countings. And there's a lot of space devoted to the countings. In the beginning of Bamidbar, there's a counting. At the end of Bamidbar, there's a counting. In Parshas Pinchas, essentially the same idea, the number, not the same, but the same process. Interesting, for those who have an eye for detail, there's one difference between them, and that is that Yosef, for both counts, is split up into two, Menashe and Ephraim, of course. And their order actually changes. In this week's parsha, Ephraim is counted before Menashe. In Pinchas, it's Menashe counted before Ephraim. If you notice that, so that's the difference between them, whatever it may represent. But essentially, the counts are the same. The same idea. The question that the Netziv raises, and much of our remarks will be based on his opening to Chumash Bamidbar, is of all the things that happened in Bamidbar, seemingly the least significant or the least meaningful are the countings. Whatever they did, whatever they were for, they were for. But Chumash Bamidbar is full of so many other things. When they weren't being counted, lots of other things were happening. This is the Chumash that has, it's got the Misonanim, it's got the Meraglim, it's got Korach, it's got Balak, it's got Zimri, lots of things are happening. And of all of those things, to, in a sense, put them to the side and refer to the entire Chumash as the Chumash of counting, that seems to be missing essentially much of what happened. In other words, if I didn't know someone better and he told me that what happens in Chumash Bamidbar is the Jewish people are counted, I would suspect that he actually had not read Chumash Bamidbar. Perhaps he started at the beginning and moved straight to the end, and all he saw was counting, and assume that's what happens in between. But of course, so much else happens in between. And yet, we give it the name Chumash HaPikudim. That's an interesting shaila. And the Netziv explains, and it is a major, really, introduction to what Chumash Bamidbar is about. As we know, life in the Midbar was quite different than life as it would be in Eretz Yisrael later on. In the Midbar, everything is miraculous. The food comes from the sky, and the water comes from the ground, and the Anane HaKavod, and there's Moshe Rabbeinu, and you've got the Mishkan. It's an entirely elevated, otherworldly almost type of existence. That will change as the Jewish people cross the Yarden into Eretz Yisrael. There will yet be Nissim, but the fabric of life will be much more normal, in a sense. The Hashgacha, that was the divine supervision that was so manifest and revealed during the Midbar, will take a more natural flow as they come into Eretz Canaan, as we know. Says the Netziv, Chumash Bamidbar is about that transition. From the supernatural of the Midbar, from the revealed supervision of the Midbar, to the concealed supervision of Eretz Yisrael. For what we need to appreciate is that transition did not happen overnight. He compares it to the weaning process, so that when a child is nursing for the mother and then he's going to start eating, that doesn't happen overnight. It's something that happens gradually, and once in a while we go back to the mother, and it's a transition. It happens in stages. He directs our attention, significantly, to the final year. The final year in the Midbar, which is really from the middle of Chukas until the end, we find that there are a number of things that take on a much more natural hue relative to the way things were until that time. We find the Jewish people need to engage much more in diplomacy. They need to send missions to the various nations, asking them to get permission to go through their land. That's not the sort of thing that they were doing when they left Mitzrayim, and no one could get in their way. And there are wars, and their wars are not entirely successful. There are certain captives taken, and they need to get them back. Things seem to be not as clear-cut. And moreover, what's very interesting is, we can see from Parshas Chukas that the symbol, in a sense, of the Hashgacha and of the miracles in the Midbar, which is Mate Moshe, Moshe's staff, and that's that. With that he splits the Yamsuf, and that's all the Makos. Moshe did not have his staff with him at all times during the 40th year. When Hashem tells him to take his staff, in the episode of the Mei Meriva, for whatever reason that he told him to, the Pasuk says that Moshe took his staff, Milifnei Hashem, and which Rashi explains, is it was in the Mishkan. It was kept in the Mishkan, because in a sense, that's being put away now. Things are changing. Things are moving from the type of operation that's represented and accompanied by Mate Moshe. In a sense, it goes into concealment as things naturalize, quote-unquote. The truth is that from a certain point of view, we see this transition earlier on. Because a symptom of what it's like to live in the Midbar is expressed in the beginning of Perek Yud Aleph. It's in Parshas Ba'alosecha. And Perek Yud Aleph begins with the Misonanim, with those who were complaining. And what's interesting about the Parsha of the Misonanim is that it lasts approximately 3 psukim. It's over almost before it started, and no one really knows what it's about. The Pasuk states in Pasuk Aleph, Vayiyam kimisonanim, they were complaining, or like complaining, kimisonanim, Rabba osni Hashem, it was evil in the ears of Hashem, Vayishmar Hashem, Vayichar apo, Hashem heard, he got angry, Vativa bamesh Hashem, Vatocha b'kseya machane, and then a fire broke out, and Pasuk Beis, they daven to Moshe, they call out to Moshe davens, the fire subsides, and Pasuk Gimel, they call it the place Tav'era. I mean, it happened so quickly. And in a sense, that's really the point, says Netziv, because they're in such close proximity to the Shechina, they're encamped around the Mishkan. They're in Shul the whole time. That's where they live, in the presence of the Shechina. And that's why if they do anything wrong, it's called Be'ozne Hashem. Be'ozne Hashem, whenever word is spoken into the ears of someone, we've seen throughout Chumash, it always refers to a very intimate type of conversation. Yehuda approaches, let him speak Be'ozne Yosef. Ephron wants to speak Be'ozne Avram with regards to. It's a private consultation that they should understand each other, which means that if something goes wrong, and that's called Be'ozne Hashem, it means that they're constantly in this very close counters with the Shina. And that itself was difficult for Bnei Yisrael, because retribution was swift. It happened just like that. And in a sense, the Jewish people are discovering that it's actually quite difficult to live that way. It's quite demanding to live that way. And what's fascinating is that means that there we could say there are two clocks in terms of the transition away from the Midbar mode to Eretz Yisrael mode. There's the way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would like it to go, but the Jewish people, their clock is a bit faster. They're actually a little bit more interested in naturalizing, because it's much more demanding to stay in this unnatural state where they can't falter in any way, they can't lower their madrega in any way. And in a sense, that's characteristic of many of the things that will happen in Chumash Bamidbar. This brings us really the central episode of Chumash Bamidbar is the Meraglim. And the age-old question with regards to the Meraglim, was it good for the Jews? Was it not good for the Jews? Was it a terrible idea? Well, it sounds like what we would call hishtadlus. It sounds like acceptable industry and initiative, and acting responsibly. Except, in a sense, the question is, it really depends how they'll enter Eretz Canaan. If they will enter, shall we say, by their own means, in a much more natural way, well, then certainly that would require reconnaissance and require that type of sending of the spies. But that itself is the question. Do they need to enter that way? If they enter, if HaKadosh Baruch Hu brings them in, so to speak, that means if they're much more colored by the way things are in the Midbar and that's how they come in, so maybe it's not necessary to send spies. So really, there's a prior question. One cannot ask, is it correct to send spies? If it's through a natural channel, yes. If higher than natural, no. So really the question is, which channel are you choosing? Which path are you choosing? Part of the prior problem is not so much that they sent spies, but they chose to enter Eretz Canaan in a way that would require to send spies, because they're looking to naturalize much quicker than is good for them. So this is what we mean when we say that there are two clocks of transition from the Midbar mode to Eretz Canaan mode. HaKadosh Baruch Hu feels and judges that they could do with a bit more time in Midbar mode, but it's difficult, and the Jewish people would like to get into natural living, so to speak, a little bit quicker. And the truth is, says Netziv, in his understanding, This is the meaning of the famous mini sefer in Chumash Bamidbar, which is right at the end of Perek Yud. It's the psukim of Vayhi ben Soha Ha'aron and Uvenucha Yomar, which are bracketed, as we know, by nuns, before and after, to tell us that there's something's happening here. And according to one opinion in Chazal, it's considered to be a sefer in its own right. Sefer Bifnei Atzmo, Bamidbar is practically looked upon as comprising three, I wouldn't call them chumashim anymore, because now there's seven of them, but three svarim, from the beginning till then, and two psukim, and then the rest of Bamidbar. And the Netziv explains that what part of what the sefer is doing here is that it's marking the beginning of the transition. Until now, they have been in pure Midbar mode. It's been about the Mishkan and matters that pertain thereto. And from this point on, it's now about how do they naturalize, on whose timetable, and on whose initiative. And the turning point are these two psukim. Because the very first thing that happens after this mini sefer is the parsha of the Misonanim, and the Jewish people are feeling that maybe they should enter a more natural mode of living. And this brings us to the Medrash Rabbah of the five references of light. We noted that the fourth reference is Vayavdel Elohim Bein Ha'or Uvein HaChoshech. And that's Chumash Bamidbar. And what's that got to do with Chumash Bamidbar? Says the Netziv, it's all about the division, the transition from light to darkness. That is to say, not that Eretz Yisrael is a place of darkness, but what it means is the divine supervision that was so manifest in that respect, and so clear, and so apparent, and so direct, and immediate, that's living in God's light. And moving from that into darkness in the sense that that light is concealed and more naturalized, the Havdalah from light to darkness is what Chumash Bamidbar is all about. And in fact, the Netziv himself doesn't mention this, but it's worthwhile adding, based on the comment of the Netziv himself and other Baalei Loshon that I've seen, it's interesting to note in Lashon HaKodesh, there are two ways to divide, or to denote a division between A and B. You can either say lahavdil bein A lebi, like we say in the Havdalah, hamavdil bein kodesh lechol, bein or lechoshech. Or one could say lahavdil bein A uvein B, like it says in Maaseh Bereishis, lahavdil bein hayom uvein halayla. What's the difference between A lebi and lahavdil bein A uvein B? That's an interesting shaila. There's two divisions. How are they different? And the Netziv explains that there's really two ways to divide between two things. You can either just put a very abrupt partition and it's either one or the other, nothing in between. Or you can have something in between. You can divide two fields by a fence, or you can divide two fields by having a third field in the middle. In both cases, the two fields are divided, but in the second instance, what divides them is its own field. And sometimes divisions have that characteristic. There's a zone. It's a transition. It doesn't happen abruptly in that way. And that's the difference between them. If it's either A or B and just a partition in between, that's Bein A Le B. But if there's something, if it's gradual and there's a zone that partakes perhaps of both characteristics, then that's called Bein A Uvein B. It's a certain continuum, and that the field in the middle is also a place. It serves not just to divide. And therefore we see, I think, the diuk here, the precision, that it states, Vayavdel Elohim Bein Ha'or Uvein HaChoshech. If Or represents the way of existing in the Midbar, and Choshech represents, in this context, the way of existing in Eretz Canaan, but the division was not immediate, it wasn't overnight, but rather it was a process from a certain point of view, a process that took almost 40 years, because it began in the beginning of the second year in some respects. So that's called Bein Ha'or Uvein HaChoshech. And in a sense, Chumash Bamidbar is the Uvein in between those two. Moreover, let's go back now to the two countings. And we will see that in a sense, as much as from a certain point of view, they're just numbers, And what does the number mean, if not just the amount of people that there are? But we'll see that the atmosphere and the form that accompanies these numbers really reflects the way of the Jewish people at that time. When they're being counted at a certain time, they're being counted as they are at that time, which means that the numbers speak in terms of the mode of existence of the Jewish people. What that means, for example, as much as they're counted both in the beginning of Bamidbar and the end, but in the beginning, the Jewish people are actually counted in two capacities. The first perek counts them as Shvatim, that will take you to Sheini. But then the second perek counts them again, but this time organizes them into machanos, into camps. Dega machane this, dega machane that. Each machane has three Shvatim, and they're kind of counted again. At the end of Bamidbar and Parshas Pinchas, they're only counted as tribes. There's no reference anymore to these machanos. I mean, where did they go? Why does the counting at the beginning of Bamidbar has tribes and camps, whereas at the end, only tribes? Well, according to the Medrash, the idea of the camps of the Jewish people is them being encamped around the Mishkan. They took their inspiration from the Malachim, V'shem Elokeinu Nidgol, and they wanted to be like that, and Hashem says, you can be like that. And they were. But in a sense, therefore, the whole idea of the Machanos is really the Jewish people around the Mishkan. And that's why you only find them being counted like that in the beginning of Bamidbar, because the beginning of Bamidbar is them in that mode, around the Mishkan. So they're not only tribes, they're also camps. But at the end of Bamidbar, in Parshas Pinchas, they've got one foot into Eretz Yisrael already. And there's no mention of camps anymore, because they're no longer encamped around the Mishkan, but they're getting ready to take their place as tribes, which means that they are counted only as tribes. That's a major distinction. And the numbers talk in that way. The mode of counting is telling in that way. There is another difference. We know that Yosef, at a certain point, in many respects, splits into two. He becomes Menashe and Ephraim. And we also know that Ephraim, although he was younger, he received a certain prominence over that of Menashe. And he got the right hand, and Yisim Chalekim Ephraim v'chim Menashe, and Ephraim kind of moved ahead, took over. The Netziv explains, both here and in Parshas Vayechi, that we need to know that Ephraim did not supersede Menashe in every respect. Rather, it is only with regards to certain things, specifically spiritual matters, that Ephraim moved ahead of Menashe. But in more temporal, physical, any of that type of metric, Menashe remained dominant. And in fact, the Netziv explains, fascinating, that at the time that Ephraim, he got the main bracha from Yaakov, the Pasuk states, Sikel es Yadav, ki Menashe ha-Bachor, it's in Bereishis, Perek Memches. Yaakov switches hands, we all have that image, for Menashe's the Bechor. And of course, all Mepharshim are wondering, well, that's not a very good reason to switch his hands. I mean, it sounds like you're explaining something. Switched his hands. Why did he switch his hands? Why did he give Ephraim the right hand? Because Menashe is the Bechor. That's not, I mean, you might want to have another explanation, because that doesn't sound like a very good reason. That sounds like an anti-reason. So much so that Rabbeinu Bachya, based on the Ibn Ezra, explains that the word ki in that pasuk means af al pi, even though. Al derech hapshat, it's almost the only way you can understand it. He gave Ephraim the right hand, even though Menashe is the Bechor, nonetheless. I mean, that's quite a drastic thing to do, al derech haparshanut. But then Netziv explains by raising another question. We know we're so used to the idea that Yaakov feels that Ephraim should get the right hand. So Yosef clearly was not expecting that. So Yosef positions Ephraim by Yaakov's left. He put Menashe at Yaakov's right. If Yaakov feels that they're not where they should be, so why does he switch his hands? He should switch his grandchildren. He should tell them to change places. With all due respect to Yosef, I have other plans. Ephraim, would you please come to my right? Menashe, would you please go to the left? It's going to come out anyway. It's an interesting shaila. And the Nitziv explains that Yaakov does not wish to change the positioning of his grandchildren. Menashe is where he should be. He's at Yaakov's right side. And Ephraim is where he should be, at Yaakov's left side. Because more to Yaakov than his hands. That where he places his hands represents the more elevated, in terms of the limbs of the body, that represents Chochmah. But where they are in terms of by his right leg also represents something. That's the physical side of things. That's the base. And the truth of the matter is that Menashe should be at Yaakov's right side, should be by his right leg, because in terms of what the leg represents, in terms of the more temporal elements, Menashe does get the right, and Ephraim gets the left. So it's actually, to borrow the expression, it's a mixed blessing, in the sense that both of them get right and left. Menashe gets the right foot and the left hand, and Ephraim gets the left foot and the right hand. And that is actually Pshuto Shel Mikra, says the Nitziv, because it explains Sikeles Yadav. He switched his hands, meaning specifically his hands. Why? Why not switch his grandchildren? The answer is Ki Menashe Bechor, because Menashe is the Bechor, and therefore in many respects he should be at Yaakov's right side. In terms of what the hand represents, Yaakov switched his hands. Sikeles Yadav Ki Menashe HaBechor. So that's a very interesting way of looking at the brachos of Ephraim and Menashe. And therefore, coming back to our parsha, and Yosef has been split up into two. Well, who should be mentioned first? Ephraim or Menashe? The answer must be, it depends. We understand that whoever is more prominent among them should be mentioned first. But we've already seen that prominence can be divided into different realms. One of them is more prominent in spiritual matters, one more in temporal matters. So really the question is, why are you counting them? In what respect are you counting them? Then, when we answer that question, we'll be able to establish who should be first. And that's why, says the Nitziv, between this Parsha and Parshas Pinchas at the end, the order is reversed. In this week's Parsha, Ephraim is first. Because the Jewish people at the beginning of Bamidbar are being counted apropos of their spiritual state. Well, spiritually, Ephraim is the prominent one, so Ephraim is mentioned before Menashe. However, in Parshas Pinchas, as they're moving more relatively towards the physical domain of Eretz Canaan, Menashe then is the one who's counted first because he's the more prominent in that respect. So every aspect of the countings reflects the nature of the Jewish people as they're being counted. And what's fascinating is we go from such broad discussions as the Nitziv does to more nuanced questions. For if we look in Perek Beis, Pasuk Kaf, and this is where they're being counted as Machanos. So in Pasuk Yud Ches, the Rosh Machaneh is Ephraim, Dego Machaneh Ephraim, and then who's next? Pasuk Kaf, V'alav Mateh Menashe. By him is Menashe. Very good, and then Mateh Binyamin is third. That's the format. You've got the Rosh Machaneh, and then by him, and then whoever comes third. What's interesting is, if we look carefully and pay attention to detail, in the other three of the Machanos, whenever it moves from the Rosh Machaneh to the next one, it doesn't say Va'alav, it says Va'achonim Alav, those that were encamped next to him. You find, for example, in the beginning of the Perek, Pasuk Gimel is Dego Machaneh Yehuda, and in Pasuk Hey, who is next to Yehuda? Va'achonim Alav Matei Yisachar. Similarly, in Pasuk Yud Degel Machaneh Reuven, and in Pasuk Yud Beis, who's next to him? Shimon. V'achonim alav Mateh Shimon. Third is our case of Ephraim and Menashe, and it breaks from that model, because instead of saying that Ephraim is hachonim alav, it says Menashe is hachonim alav, it says Menashe is alav. V'alav Mateh Menashe. What is the Pasuk intimating to us by removing the word Vachonim? And in the fourth one, it will go back to Vachonim Alav. So this is the exception in the four. And the Nitziv explains, based on his analysis, that v'achonim alav literally means that they're camping nearby. And that's what it means, and that's all there is to it. When it comes to Menashe, there's another layer of the message here. Because it doesn't just want to say that Menashe is encamped near Ephraim. It wants to remind us that from a certain point of view, Menashe is greater than Ephraim. The Olav, he's counted second here, but in other respects, he is Olav. He is higher than Ephraim, as will come out later in the Chumash. And therefore, that reminder, there's a duality here. He's counted second, but he is Olav in many respects. And that's why it took out the word Vachonim. Menashe is next to him, but also above him in certain ways. Just not yet. Just not in terms of this count. And I have to say, there is a PS here, which was added by the son of the Netziv, Rav Chaim Berlin, who was the Rav in Moscow for many years, and later on here in Yerushalayim. And the Netziv quotes him, Ubeni Haga'on Rav Chaim. So, sounds good already. And the truth is, it's such a delicate thing that Rav Chaim Berlin is about to say. The only reason that I mention it is because it is absolutely unbelievable. And it's as follows. There is a Mishnah which discusses the Lechem Haponim, as you mentioned in Parshas Emor. What's Lechem Haponim? You've got the two formations of six loaves each, equals 12, and they're on the Shulchan, and that's that. Now the Pasuk says, V'samta al amareches levona zaka. Levona, that spice, frankincense, I believe it's called. So that the two spoons of levona are also on the Shulchan. Alav, ala marechet, on the marechet, on the formations. And the question is, where do you place the levona? And you may be surprised to hear, it's a machlokas. According to the Chachamim, the Pasuk says, put them on the marechet. That's where you put them, on the marechet. You put the, each formation of six. On top of it, you put the spoon of levona. That's that. Abba Shaul, one of the Tanoim in the Mishnah, says, you put the levona next to the marechet. Not on top of it, next to it. They said to him, but the Pasuk says you put ala marechet on top. Says Abba Shaul, al can mean next to. And I quote as my example, says Abba Shaul, va'alav mate Menashe. Menashe weren't on top of Ephraim, they were next to them. And therefore alav means next to, and that's what it means here. Okay, that's the machlokas in the Mishnah. It happens, and it will happen again. But what's interesting is the Tosfos Yom Tov, in his commentary to the Mishnah there, points out Abba Shaul could have adduced a pasuk from much earlier on that the word alav means next to. I mean, that's really what he means. Alav can mean adjacent to. You've got two camps prior to this. You've got Va'alav, Mate Shimon, Alav, and Ma'alav, whoever else, right? For the first two machanos. Va'achonim alav, Mate Shimon, Va'achonim alav, Mate Zvulon. So how come he waited until the third time you see the word alav and then says, oh, you see, alav means adjacent. It meant adjacent the first two times as well? That's an interesting question. That's a rather delicate question. Okay. Says Reb Chaim, perhaps the reason why he chose as his source this alav is because there's an affinity between the alav of Menashe and the alav of the Levona and the Lechem Aponim. You see, the Lechem Aponim, should we ask the question, which is more significant, which is more prominent, the bread or the spices? Well, the intuitive answer is the bread. I mean, the spices are an accessory, they're an accompaniment to it, but the ikkar is the bread itself. Yes. But in some respects, the Levona is more chashuv than the bread. Because the bread is eaten by the Kohanim, the Levona goes on to the Mizbeach. So they have an interest, they have a mixed relationship where one is clearly the ikkar in terms of this context, but not in every respect. In certain respects, what seems to be secondary is actually primary, and that's called va'alav, and that exactly mirrors the relationship between Ephraim and Menashe. In this context, Ephraim is primary. They're about to enter the midbar in that way. But in some respects, Menashe is alav, just like the Levona. That's why Abba Shaul chose the alav that he chose is from Ephraim and Menashe. I mean, this is parshanut on altogether different level. And we've gone from such major discussions, as we're saying, the nature of Chumash Bamidbar entirely, to the subtleties of the changes in terminology, both in the Pasuk and ultimately in the Mishnah. Well, but in any case, to bring all of this together, says the Netziv, it's for this reason we can understand that the Chumash is called by Chazal Chumash HaPekudim, the Chumash of the Countings. And we asked, I mean, the counting seemed to be the least significant thing that happened. Didn't so many other things happen? Yes, says the Netziv, so many other things happened, but they're all revolving around the issue of the transition of the Jewish people, Bein Ha'or Uvein HaChoshech. And the brackets that really show you the difference in landscape between those two ways of being, or of the beginning and Choshech towards the end, you can see it in the numbers if you know how to read them. If you pay attention to who's being counted, in what way are they being counted, in what order they're being counted, the numbers say it all. So they are atmospheric bookends of Chumash Bamidbar, and the entire Chumash therefore is called Chumash HaPekudim. So this is the introduction of the Netziv to Bamidbar. Extremely profound and not the lightest of discussions, but nonetheless certainly a great deal to think about as we move through Chumash Bamidbar. Let's turn our attention now to the beginning of Perek Gimel, and we will see quite a well-known comment of Rashi. And we may discover that there's another way to look at this pasuk. Everyone's been counted, and now we move to Aaron and Moshe, and the pasuk says, Ve'ele toldos Aaron and Moshe, these are the children of Aaron and Moshe, Be'yom diber Hashem es Moshe b'har Sinai. And Hashem spoke to Moshe b'har Sinai. Next, Ve'ele shemos b'nei Aaron ha'bechor nadav v'aviyu elozav v'itamar, etc., and so forth. And Rashi comments, don't forget, you introduced toldos Aaron and Moshe. You went on to mention the sons of Aaron. There's no mention of the sons of Moshe. Rashi comments, Ve'ele toldos Aaron u Moshe, Ve'eino mazkir ela b'nei Aaron. It only mentions, you introduced the sons of Aaron and Moshe, you mention only the sons of Aaron. Where are Moshe's sons? Says Rashi, V'nikru'u toldos Moshe. Aaron's sons are called Moshe's sons. Why? Lefi shelimdan Torah. Because he taught them Torah. Melamed, which teaches us, Shekol ha-melamed, es ben chaveiru Torah, one who teaches his friend's son Torah, ma le'olav akosuv ki li yulado, he becomes like his child, he's considered like his child. That's the connection that's forged through teaching Torah. What is bothering Rashi, shall we say? Why does Rashi bring in this comment? Well, Rashi has spoken for himself, but actually there are two points. Firstly, as we mentioned, that the Torah told us Aaron and Moshe, and then only mentions the sons of Aaron. Sons of Moshe have gone missing. That's a pshat issue. Secondly, how does the pasuk conclude? Ve'ele told us Aaron and Moshe, these are his sons, or their sons. B'yom divar Hashem es Moshe b'har Sinai, on the day that Hashem spoke to Moshe at Har Sinai. How is that a qualifying Aaron's sons? They were Aaron's sons before that day. They were Aaron's sons after that day. They were Aaron's sons on that day. But how is that a timestamp for what we're talking about? I mean, they were Aaron's sons for years and years. So what's the meaning of this qualifying phrase? B'yom divar Hashem es Moshe. And that's why, as Rashi goes on to say, it's because of what Hashem said to Moshe when he spoke to him, and Moshe passed that on to Aaron's children. That's how they became like Moshe's children. That's how the two parts of the pasuk fit together. These are the sons of Aaron, but they're also considered Moshe's sons. You know why? Because Hashem spoke to Moshe, and Moshe spoke to them, and that's he taught them Torah. They become like his sons. What's interesting is, Mefarshim ask, to use the classic modern Hebrew expression, Im Kvar, Az Kvar. If you say that by teaching someone Torah, you become like their father, so then I would say that Moshe has many more than just four additional children. He taught Torah to the entire Jewish people. Torah tzivul and Moshe. So Moshe should be, the entire Jewish people should be considered toldos Moshe. An interesting question. I mean, we've opened up the gates. So Mefarshim explain that in order to establish this relationship, that the Rebbe, the teacher, is like the Talmud is his child, it can't just, quote unquote, be telling him halachas or telling him the mitzvahs generally. It has to be a more involved discussion of the mitzvahs. It has to be a deeper level of transmitting Torah. And then he becomes like a parent to him. And as we know, the way the Gemara in Eruvin and Daf Nun Daled describes Moshe, when he would give over what's called Seder Mishnah, Keset Seder Mishnah, he would actually tell Torah to Aaron's sons before he told Torah to anyone else. First to Aaron, then Aaron's sons, then the Shivim Zakenim, and then to the rest of Yisrael. Moshe gave over Torah everything he said four times. But the point is, it wasn't just repeating. He didn't just say the paragraph to Aaron and say it again to Aaron's sons. There were things that he could say to Aaron and then to Aaron's sons. I guess he's not going to be considered Aaron's father. He's his brother. But to Aaron's sons, he could talk to them in a way. That's why they came in first, because there were elements and layers and levels of the mitzvah that he was communicating that he couldn't tell everybody else. But to them he told. And that forged a special bond between them. And that's why they specifically are considered his sons. And what's interesting is, again, to the details, if we look back at Pasuk Aleph, which states, Ve'ele toldos Aaron and Moshe, again, that's the Pasuk we're dealing with, the sons of Aaron and Moshe, they're also considered Moshe's sons because of what Hashem said to him, Biyom Dibra Hashem Es Moshe Bahar Sinai. That is discordant. That's dissonant. Because you normally speak El. In the rest of Torah, Vayidaber Hashem, El Moshe, Daber El. And therefore it should have said, B'yom Diber Hashem, El Moshe Bahar Sinai. But it says, B'yom Diber Hashem, Es Moshe Bahar Sinai. What's the difference between them? Diber Es has a connotation of a much closer discussion. Speaking with, we would say, as opposed to speaking to. And it represents all of those aspects of the mitzvah that are in themselves much more intimate and much more involved and deeper. And therefore, to the rest of Bnei Yisrael, Moshe communicated what Hashem had spoken, El Moshe. But to Aaron's sons, he communicated the things that Hashem spoke, Es Moshe. And that's why they were considered to be like his sons. So says Rashi. Now, the points of Rashi are very clear. His questions are clear. His responses from the Medrash. There doesn't seem to be any other way to approach these psukim, because Moshe's children are not mentioned and they've been introduced. So it's got to be like Rashi said. Well, the Ramban explains that it's possible to approach this pasuk al derech hapshat without the Medrash. And it's introducing Moshe's children. How can this be? Well, the Pasuk introduces the sons of Aaron and Moshe. It then proceeds to talk about the sons of Aaron. It doesn't proceed to talk about the sons of Moshe. Where are they? Says Ramban, they will also be presented, just not yet. Their time to be presented hasn't come yet. But they will be presented in Perek Kaf Zayin. Now remember, where are we? We're in Perek Gimel. Perek Kaf Zayin adds a lot of haftorahs are going to, a lot of kiddushes and shul are going to happen between now and then. But nonetheless, says Ramban, it is a long play. It has a very long reach. Sometimes the Torah can introduce. The introduction is not realized, so to speak, and fully filled in for a while. Except, let us ask, and by the way, where are Moshe's sons mentioned? In Perek Kaf Zayin, which is in Parshas Pinchas, it refers to Mishpachat HaAmrami, the Mishpacha of Amram. Says Ramban, who's the Mishpacha of Amram in terms of his descendants? Amram had three children. Miriam, Aaron, and Moshe. Aaron's children are mentioned separately, always, so they're not Mishpachat Amrami. Miriam's children, she was married to Kalev, which means that they now follow the tribe of Yehuda. There's only one person left of the three whose children are really called Mishpachat Amrami. That's Moshe. And that's Eile told us Moshe. Now should you say, well, if you introduced in general everyone here in Perek Gimel, how come you didn't talk about everyone at the same time? Aaron and Elazar Itamar and then Moshe's children. Why did you wait? And the Ramban explains with a fascinating approach that there's a big difference between Aaron's sons and Moshe's sons, even in terms of their yichus. Aaron's sons are Kohanim. Moshe's sons are Leviim. Kohanim are already a special entity at this stage. Leviim, not yet. Not worthy of mention. How so? You see, says Ramban, that the Kohanim have already been set aside for special mention in Chumash Shemos. In Parsh Tetzaveh, Aaron and his sons, they were involved in the Miluim. So Kohuna is already a Yichus by this stage. Leviim are about to become, but not yet. Those are the parshas that will be as a result of the Egel, that then the Leviim were chosen. They are yet to happen as a significant entity. When they do, they will then be mentioned as Mishpachat HaAmrami. But really what the Ramban is saying is, you see that the Torah gives explicit mentioning by name for those who it means something to be mentioned by name at that time. In the beginning of Chumash Bamidbar, it already means something to be a Kohen. It doesn't yet mean something to be a Levi. But it will. And when it does, then they'll be mentioned as well. That's how he explains the division, Al Derech HaPshat. And moreover, says Ramban, that's why the Pasuk, look again at Pasuk Aleph, it's a new Pasuk now. Perek Gimel Pasuk Aleph, the Eile told us Aaron and Moshe, these are the descendants of Aaron and Moshe, but it will begin with B'yom Dibra Hashem Es Moshe Bahar Sinai, from the time that Hashem spoke to Moshe at Har Sinai. When he spoke to Moshe at Har Sinai, he only spoke to him about Kohanim. He didn't speak to him about Leviim. This final phrase of Pasuk Aleph is explaining who's significant at this stage. Those that were mentioned at Har Sinai. Kohanim, not yet Leviim. Leviim to follow. And what's very interesting, just parenthetically, but quite certainly requires more discussion, is that we should not forget, according to the Ramban, he's very reluctant ever to invoke the principle of Ein Mukdam Umeuchar by Torah. Rashi uses it more, Ramban almost never. And what that means is, Aaron is mentioned as being the Kohen Gadol, and his sons are mentioned as being Kohanim in Parshas Tetzaveh, that's before the Torah writes about the Chet HaEgel. And according to the Ramban, that means that they were set aside as the significant personalities for the Mishkan before the Egel, meaning irrespective of the Egel. It wasn't because of the Egel. The Leviim, the choosing of Leviim, is explicitly in the Torah tied to the Egel because of what happened. Shevet Levi came, and therefore they replaced the Bechorim. But the Kohanim, it's not about the Egel. And that's very interesting because we normally are of the understanding that the Bechorim before Chet HaEgel, that's what you had. And there was no such thing as Kohanim. The Bechorim, when they fell from grace, because of the Egel, there's a reshuffle, and now the Kohanim take prime position, and Leviim second to them. According to Ramban, Kohanim had already been promoted in that way before the Egel, irrespective of the Egel. And that itself now is would need to be investigated as to why that is. Whatever happened to the Bechorim, it seems it was a natural transition, not a product of the Chet HaEgel. In any case, says Ramban, that is how I understand the Pasuk Al Derech HaPshat. Except, and again, just to summarize in one sentence, the Pasuk has introduced the children of Aaron and Moshe, and then will immediately follow with Aaron, who are already significant personalities, and subsequently, just have a bit of patience, in Perek of Zion, we'll get round to Moshe's descendants, who were also introduced in the beginning of Perek Gimel. The only thing, says Ramban, is I completely understand why the Medrash says what it said, because that's quite a thing to say, Al Derech HaPshat, that it's introduced them and it hasn't spoken about them yet. Al Derech HaPshat, it might be. Sometimes the Drash, as its name suggests, is Doresh more. It demands more. If you introduce them, it demands that you talk about them. And if you didn't, you've got to be saying something else. And therefore, says Ramban, certainly there's room for the Medrash to show us this additional message that they've introduced ostensibly as Moshe and Aaron's children, and only Aaron's children are mentioned. They've got to be like Moshe's children. Enter the Medrash. There's room for that. And both are true. There's room for both, says Ramban, paraphrasing his famous formulation, HaTorah Tifaresh V'Tirmoz. The Torah states certain things explicitly. It alludes to certain things. The Torah communicates on many wavelengths. And therefore, on a Pshat wavelength, way to Parshas Pinchas, on a Drash wavelength, the teacher's like the father. And those two messages accompany each other and complement each other. HaPshat Yipashet V'Drash Yidarish. I'd just like to spend the final few moments referring to something that caught my attention today, or more correctly, it caught my attention many times in the past, and then I let it go again because I didn't know what to do with it. In Perek Aleph, Pasuk Yud Dalet, where we talk about the Nasi of Gad, his name is, in Perek Aleph, Pasuk Yud Dalet, Legad Eliasaf Ben Du'uel. That's his name. Okay. He's mentioned again in Perek Beis, Pasuk Yud Dalet. There, which is already in the Parsha of the Machanos, there he is called, Pasuk Yud Dalet, with Mate Gad, the Nasi of Negad, Eliasaf ben Reuel. Of all of the personalities, and they're all mentioned twice, all the Nasir mentioned twice, the Nasi of God, his name has changed from Eliasaf ben Deuel to Eliasaf ben Reuel. It's the sort of thing that if you go through the Parsha, you can note it, but you're not sure what to do with it. So you look in Pasuk Aleph, Parsha Aleph, and it says Deuel, and Perek Beis says Reuel, and you check, and then you check your glasses, and they're okay, and then you go weiter. But then I came across a statement of the Baalei HaTosfos, quoted by the Chidah, which could illuminate for us. The Roshei Machaneh, Degel Machaneh, there's only four. Interestingly, there's four Bechorim amongst the Jewish people, in the fullest sense of the word, because Yaakov had four wives. So the Bechor of Leah is Reuven, and the Bechor of Rachel is Yosef, and the Bechor of Bilhah is Dan, and the Bechor of Zilpah is Gad. You've got four Bechorim. Three of them became Roshei Machaneh, and one of them didn't. Reuven, Degel Machaneh Reuven. Dan, Degel Machaneh Dan. Yosef, Ephraim in this case, Degel Machaneh Ephraim. And who's the fourth one? Yehuda, Degel Machaneh Yehuda. We understand why Yehuda is a Rosh Machaneh. He's the Melech. But what that means is that the tribe of Gad is the only Bechor, interesting to look about it in this way, he's the only Bechor that did not take his place as a Rosh Machaneh. And the Baalei HaTosfos say that it's in praise of the Nasi of Gad. He didn't make a fuss. He didn't say, you know, they're all Machaneh, and they're all Bechorim, and I'm also Bechor. He saw that Moshe chose someone else as Rosh Machaneh, and so be it. He takes his place with the other Shvatim. It was an act of grace. It was an act of forbearance. And that is why his name changed. Because Deuel means, I mean, when you say the son of someone, it's a characteristic of the person. Deuel from the word Dea, to know. Reuel is from the word Rea, which is a fellow. Something happened. In the beginning of the Parsha, his name is Ben Deuel. He knows God, right? He's wise and he's knowledgeable, and which is good. But there's a greater level. It's called Reuel, to be a friend, to be a fellow, to emulate Hashem, to act in a godly way, to act with grace, to act with forbearance. And that's what happened in Perek Beis. Because in Perek Beis, someone else is Rosh Machaneh. Someone else could be the Rosh Machaneh. In so doing, he took all of his knowledge and turned it into godly practice. And that's when he changed from being Ben Deuel to being Ben Reuel. And that really is the aspiration of anyone who knows godly things. Anyone who knows Torah, they should be looking to move, to take that knowledge, to implement it, and to live it, and to move from a de'u to a re'u. Certainly a timely message as we approach the time of Kabbalah HaTorah, not only de'u'el, but also ultimately to act in accordance, act accordingly, and to become nothing less than re'u'el, as Eliasaf himself did. We'll leave it over there.